All right, guys, we're just about ready to go. Here we go.
You're tuned into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio from the Lion Hotel in Washington, D.C. I'm your host today, Casey Danielson. This episode is part of our All Things Creative series, where we explore the arts in D.C. My co-host today is Olubunmi Bakare, who is also a member of the Studio Lab and D.C. Public Library. Our guest today is Juan Pablo Guzman, a filmmaker from Guatemala, who I actually met through the D.C. Public Library Studio Lab. We could talk briefly about that. So my memory is that you came in and you had a whole bunch of really interesting footage of the subject of your film, which is the Guatemalan genocide during the early 80s. You came in with a lot of raw footage, photos, and sort of an interesting story that you didn't really know how to put together. Since then, we've talked a lot about how to sort of structure your film, how to put together all of the story, especially since the story is not over yet. There's still some stuff in courts. So maybe you could start by telling us briefly what the film is about, the project that you're working on now. I know that it's sort of a sprawling thing, but the one that you're really focused on now. And thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. So this documentary, it's about the how the people resist to the genocide and displaced operations in Guatemala during the 82, 83, 84, 85. So those years, it was difficult to people in Guatemala to survive those military operations. Yeah, we're talking about in a specific place and in Department Quiché and Municipality of Nevaj. And that specific community that's the documentary about, it's the name is Tzalbal.
Okay.
Tzalbal is the name of the community. So they live in those years, like the genocide operations and the military go through the community, mm-hmm. and they run away, and they have to sleep 5 days in the mountains, mm-hmm. or in the rivers, close to the rivers, outside of the houses, and then go back when the military goes to go to other place. So those experience create a community resistance. And in terms of how they grow food, how they sleep outside of the houses, and how to maintain those resistance activities, mm-hmm. and in poor conditions. And some people died by starving, mm-hmm. starving. Some people died like a simple cold.
Yeah, exposure.
Yeah, and some people run like 100 kilometers away from that point.
So is that when they were bombing, or is that when they were displacing people?
Yeah, they do very, very many things to displace people. They beginning to kidnapping leaders of the community. And then they introduce the patrols, mm-hmm. through the communities, and they bombing in front of the patrol to displace the people and push away to their communities. And the objective of this displacement is the measure land to create a Aldeas Modelo. It's the name for model villages to reconstruct the area in the thought of the military, not in the way of the Mayan culture Ixil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the concentration camps, and then the people, the model cities being sort of McDonald's versions of what the original, I mean, I read a bit about how they were trying to recreate the original culture or whatever after they had already sort of ripped it apart.
Yeah, the communities have the Mayan culture very hard and strong in the how they organize, how they live, how they grow the children, and the army go there and change their mind, change to the military. They introduce Spanish. Mm. They introduce Christianity, and they introduce to obey the army really hard.
You know, when you came in and we were talking about this, I couldn't help but sort of think back to the Ken Burns The West, the series, which is basically about how the Americans did the exact same thing here
to the native
folks. And they said, you know, they come, these people are living on the land, and they say, well, you know, legally, you don't really own that land.
Yep.
So maybe if we just sort of said we owned it and let you live on it for a while, and then slowly we pull, you know, individual liberties away until they say, you guys aren't welcome here anymore. And wasn't that, so there was a word, so I know the government used the term evictions, and that at the time that was legal to do evictions, but you mentioned there was also some psychological tactics used on the people to sort of disconnect them, to make it easier to dominate them. Do you know any specifics of how they did that psychological stuff?
Yeah, they introduced programs like Fusiles y Frijoles. It's an ideological term. It's the name Fusiles and Beans.
Mm-hmm.
You surrender and they provide food. This is a Fusiles y Frijoles plan.
Mm-hmm.
So they control the population and reduce in number of people, like murder, and the space of the...
They use the word reduce?
Reduce, yeah. They reduce the communities to a specific piece of land.
Mm.
Right.
So this is one of those angry part of the story.
Yeah.
Because the people, it was displaced, and the government steal the land from them.
Mm.
Yeah.
And they reduce it, and they control very hard what they grow and where they could move.
I'm just curious, why this particular area? What was so special about this area?
This is the question everybody knows. Wants to know, because this is the Ixil people. It was a very strong indigenous community,
mm-hmm.
and they don't permit the government introduce their ideas.
Mm.
And during those years, they have an idea. They introduced the evangelic Christianism,
Christianity
to reorder. Right. Those. So this is the main thing.
Reorder.
So they were taking away the indigenous beliefs.
Yes.
And introducing something foreign.
Right. Replacing them with what they, you know, that. Yeah. So.
Yeah. One of those sayings the military have during this when they start to the model villages,
mm-hmm.
concentrated camps.
Yeah.
They said, you don't know what the government do for you. You have to say thank you because the government provide you the food, the electricity, and you don't have to believe in the Mayan culture. Mm. If you believe in the Mayan culture, we're going to kill you. Mm. You have to be Christianity right now.
Mm. So do you think that we do have a clip of, we have a few clips we want to play. Talking about this, do you think any, which one do you think we could start on?
Yeah, the Jemery Simmons is a journalist,
okay.
who visited those areas,
yeah.
during the 1982.
Okay.
So that's the most reference to the external journalist, the Washington Post journalist, to tell us how was visited that land.
Okay, so let's take a listen to the Jemery Simmons interview, and then we can talk about it.
I was working on a film called Titular de Hoy Guatemala with a Finnish film crew and a journalist, Alan Nairn. And we had gone to Nebach. And at that time, the now president of Guatemala, Otto Perez Molina, was the base commander in Nebach. And so if you can imagine this scenario, it's, what, 4 or 5 months after Rios Montt took office. And Nebach was what they call La Cocina de la Guerra, the, you know, the sort of the vortex of the war. And it was completely occupied by the army, as were dozens of other communities. The army was in the main plaza. They were in the bell tower. They had taken over the convent and the local rectory. The nuns and priests had fled for a year or two. And they were just ubiquitous. And so you have this occupied town with uniformed soldiers everywhere, with machine gun nests pointed at the plaza. And there it is. It was Independence Day. And we were in Nebach. And we had just filmed these 4 dead alleged guerrillas inside the army garrison. Perez Molina had actually showed them to us. And now there's a parade the next day. And people are sort of strutting down these muddy streets in these majorette uniforms, and these local organizations are marching. And it all ends up, ends up in a soccer stadium in Nebach. And this man comes up to this short Indian man who was a school teacher there with his students. And he asked us, he said, are you with the State Department? Are you CIA? Are you Peace Corps workers? And we said, no, no, no. And we said, we're journalists. And he finally kind of believed us. And he said, I want to tell you a story, but I can't do it here. Because this soccer stadium was just filled with uniformed soldiers, with plainclothes, judiciales, and with Perez Molina. And so we agreed to meet him on the outskirts of Nebach a few hours later. And we filmed him with his back to us. And he told us a story that he had personally witnessed of a massacre that took place in early April, just 2 or 3 weeks after the Rios Montt coup. And what happened was he was teaching in a town, Akul, which is near Nebach, it's within walking distance, and the army came in. And they rounded up all the men, about 4 dozen men, and they arbitrarily assigned them to La Gloria or El Infierno, heaven or hell, completely arbitrarily. Half of them went to heaven, the other half went to hell. The army then shot the half who went to El Infierno, and they ordered the ones who were saved to La Gloria to bury the others. And this man was one of those who had been saved, and he had to bury his fellow townsmen. So they buried them, and the parting words of the army was, this is the new law of Rios Montt.
That's amazing.
Mm. It's hard. That's sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the people who are there now, do they have a memory of this?
Yes, yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, they survive.
They survive. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, what are they? Have they moved on? Have they? I know that there's still court cases, and there are some things that to be settled. You said in February, right?
Yes.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully. What's coming up in February?
Yeah,
because your film, it's not, you're not going to focus on all this stuff because there's just so much. When we talked about it, I think we were saying, you know, okay, we now have 4 protagonists and 4 antagonists, and it's getting complicated. So probably sectioning it off into smaller bits makes sense. And you know, something I remember when we were sitting in the studio. So we met at the studio lab. You came in to work on film, and just kind of one of our coworkers, Will, was helping with Adobe Premiere, and just kind of and you picked it up very fast and have been working on it since. So you had been filming a case in Tabal, right?
Tabal.
In 2011. And there were meetings and mobilizations, and you had tons and tons and tons of footage of that.
Mm-hmm.
What were the meetings about?
Yeah, the meetings, it's about how to the communities try to convince practically, to convince the institution of the government to restore the land. Because these institutions, they have policies and they have a development projects involved. So they completely ignore the peace agreements who say they restore the land. So they with lawyers and the community's opinions and the major opinions, they try to convince how is the way to restore the land with the most quickly time. But those institutions deny it was stalled. They deny to restore the land to the easy way.
Mm-hmm.
And they pursue it to divide the community opinion, because the community, it's unified right now.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of work since the peace to the present date. 1986 it was the peace to the present date, to reconstruct the community again with all problems and polarized division, parties, churches and opinions. They have a lot of work to reunify the community. And they have a strong opinion about how the land have to restore. And the president in 2012, it was Otto Perez Molina.
Mm-hmm.
And the case start during these days.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody knows this ex-president in 2012, it was a military in the genocide operations in Nevaj, precisely in Salval. So they understand how the past impact to the present.
The future. Right.
Yeah, yeah. And they know why is the goal to stole the land. They are afraid to hydroelectric projects, mining projects,
mm-hmm. and water projects. It always comes back to that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they understand how those projects it could development in their land. So they don't want to restore the land because they have the government have projects.
Yeah, there's money.
Background.
Yeah. There's money tied up in it.
So yeah. Is there any fear amongst the people? Like when you went to the meetings and so forth, is there anybody that's afraid? Is anybody...
No. They preserve the peace because they are so angry, they are so sad with the past, and they want to be happy,
mm-hmm.
and peaceful.
Okay.
So they preserve that energy and that vibe and those reunions. And some reunions are tensions,
mm-hmm.
because the ideological thoughts,
mm-hmm.
it's a present, mm-hmm. today. But they want to preserve the past mostly. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
So the villain, or one of the villains, seems to be
Otto Perez Molina.
Molina.
Mm-hmm.
Who took part in, supervised a lot of the worst parts of this. We have a clip. It's a clip of an interview on Democracy Now. It's exclusive. Alain Nairn. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we could listen to that and then talk about it.
These sweeps were intense. The soldiers said that often they would kill about a third of a town's population. Another third they would capture and resettle in army camps, and the rest would flee into the mountains. There in the mountains, the military would pursue them using U.S.-supplied helicopters, U.S. and Israeli-supplied planes. They would drop U.S. 50-kilogram bombs on them, and they would machine gun them from U.S. Huey and Bell helicopters using U.S.-supplied heavy-caliber machine guns.
Let's turn to a clip of you interviewing a soldier in the Highlands. This is from a Finnish documentary, is that right? And when was this done? When were you talking to soldiers there?
This was in September of 1982 in the Ischiel zone in the area surrounding the town of Nebach.
Let's go to a clip of this interview.
This is how we are successful. And also, if we have already interrogated them, the only thing we can do is kill them.
And how many did you kill?
We killed a majority. There is nothing else to do than kill them.
So you killed them at once?
Yes, if they do not want to do the right things, there is nothing more to do than bomb the houses.
Okay, so that's sort of hard to listen to, but it's there's a lot of dark parts of this story, including the genocide, including stealing land, including the reason behind it being natural resources and hydroelectric and all that kind of stuff. But overall, you as a your vision and as a filmmaker, you're way of telling it is actually much more positive. Mm-hmm. And you focus a lot on sort of the hopeful future, not necessarily focusing on, you know, the terrible things that have happened in the past, and mostly just letting people get back to some sense of order. When you're dealing with all these different horrible moments and all these really sad and heart-wrenching stories, how do you start piecing this together into a narrative? How are you gonna? I know it's not finished and we're still in production, but how are you thinking about putting this story together cinematically?
Yeah, well, one of those my interest is in about the how the people resist. They resist during the displace operation, and they resist right now, because the government doesn't want to get back the land. Mm-hmm. So they have a judicial case, and they have a lot of meetings, and they have a lot of activities to convince those institutions. So I have a lot of information, photos, how the government stole the land. But the most difficult part, it's how to reconstruct how the people resist. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those my idea, to understand how the people resist and persist, even the violence, even the poverty, and even the government try to attack them again. So this is the
it's
one
resistance and overcoming.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And the spirit of the people.
Yeah, yeah, the spirit, because they have a strong soul. Mm-hmm. Every Ischiel have a strong positions. Mm-hmm. They don't want to get back. They just move.
Yeah, because they're basically defenseless in a way. They don't have the weaponry.
Yeah.
So all they have is their spirit.
Yeah.
And they're using that to...
Yeah.
Wow.
They have the spirit when they survive, and they have the spirit when they get back after the peace. And they have that spirit right now. They fighting for in the judicial case.
So that, I mean, from an outsider's point of view, I don't know if Bumi, when you're looking at just the way that the story happened, sort of trying to figure out what's the hook as far as, you know, filmmaking and the idea of focusing on resistance.
That's the idea.
Yeah. Because it's positive. It includes sort of a acknowledgement of the past and that, and then sort of puts it behind.
But the struggle is still continuing, right? So yeah. It's not necessarily behind, it's continuing. So you're still, it's like a ongoing thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, one of those sayings that people have is, we don't came here in front of you to ask forgive us.
Mm-hmm.
We ask for justice.
Ouch.
And yeah. this is they say it in front of the people mm-hmm. who steal the land.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the one of those.
Yeah, we don't want your forgiveness. Obvious. We just want want what's ours.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. That's the strongest of the people, is Ishil culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is what the government wants destroyed during the genocide.
Mm-hmm.
That spirit, that energy mm-hmm. of the
Ishil. And it didn't work.
Didn't work. Yeah. They survived. They still live.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, that kind of ties into a lot of resistance struggles around the world. Like, the people are like, I don't want your form of, I don't want your culture. I want to keep mine.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like the story of any, like, you go anywhere, you can tie that into resistance in Africa, for instance, in different countries in Africa. Like, they want to take the culture and replace it with something else. And the people are like, no, we want to keep our culture. You can have yours. And it's like the people that are in charge are the ones who say, look, we'll give you this if you take that. And the people are like, no, we want to keep ours.
Mm-hmm.
So
are you thinking of anything in particular? I know that you've worked a little bit.
So many things are going through my mind right now.
Well,
but
open that mouth. Let's hear it.
No. let's focus on.
Well, but it's interesting, the idea that it's a universal story.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's interesting. So you do have some background in some documentary work in your Africa project, right?
No? Not really.
That you want to share?
Well, not that I want to share. And the subject of that particular documentary is not really related to this, and you know, it's not in the same vein as what he's working on.
But as far as trying to construct, I mean, trying to construct a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
If resistance is the narrative, you know, where else do we see that? I mean,
well, when I try to think in that way, mm-hmm. it's a what they eat during they hiding.
Or what they ate?
What they ate, yeah. I try to put it in their shoes
mm-hmm.
and say why they run that way, why they persist in the same area during 2 years, long years.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and how they saw the army in the one part of the river and they had it in another point. And how they hiding in a small piece of land. We're not talking about miles.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about 1 kilometer square to they survive.
For two years.
Yeah, that resistance. And they grow food and they grow children
mm-hmm.
in that situation.
In that,
and some
under
people,
those restrictions, man. That is.
Yeah, some people run away
mm-hmm.
and some people surrender. And that's resistance.
Yeah.
Something did come to mind. Have you heard of a woman by the name of Wangari Maathai?
Mm-hmm.
And so you've heard about her resistance in Kenya. It was something similar where the government was grabbing these, you know, public lands. Mm-hmm. And this woman, she said, wait a minute. You know, you're destroying the forest. You're destroying the rivers. And she went up against the army, like literally, like it, over time it grew. Like the people started standing behind her, but initially she was alone. I mean, and she would get beat down like literally knocked upside her head. And it was her, it was other women in the country. Eventually, the folks got behind her and, you know, she started planting trees, you know, to kind of replace the land that had been destroyed earlier. And gosh, so, I mean, you know, she's since, you know, passed away. But she fought until the end to say, hey, you can't touch the land. You know, if you destroy the land, if you cut down trees, if you knock down the forest, that's like the lungs of the world. Like, you know, you destroy the trees, you destroy the land, you essentially destroy the people.
That's a type of genocide.
Yeah.
They have a one knowledge about this thought because they hiding inside of the forest.
Mm.
And when the
forest was protection.
The forest was protecting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they said, well, the forest is our house.
Mm-hmm.
The forest is our hospital.
Mm-hmm.
The forest is our school.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to preserve that forest.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say, if those armies came again,
mm-hmm.
we have the forest to hide again. Mm-hmm. So that's the thought of the resistance. They have an alternative way to do things. And the government could say, destroy that forest.
Mm-hmm.
But the committee say, no.
Yeah, but
and that
what
is,
happens if that does happen? Though,
yeah, and that is small thoughts and specific thoughts. The government doesn't understand when they do a highway, when they do a road, when they do the building, when they do the development things. Some of those projects who is involved cause division because they have a different thoughts of how they do the thing.
So essentially what we're talking about is greed.
Yeah.
You know, the interest of one and not thinking about all.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a very small thought that people have memory. And it's about the memory. They have memory in their languages, language, and they have a memory in their skin and their bones because they resist the cold weather, even when they hide them. So they have a lot of physical memory.
The spirit of the ancestors.
And physical memory, and they transmit into to the kids how they grow the kids,
Well, and it's interesting how small. So, I mean, if we look at this on a map, we're talking about a very small area, and it's a very specific story. It's a universal story because it happens all over the place, has happened, will continue to happen. But your story. One reason why it'll work as a movie is because it's a small enough story. It's specific to this one little area.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I remember being sort of a little bit of a complication was that if you're thinking about your audience, for the most part, you're making the film for the people of that ethnic group to see so that they have some... they feel that they have some representation, or they want it. They want it to represent them accurately.
Mm-hmm.
But culturally, they're so different from maybe what a normal mainstream audience would be. So I know that you were thinking about doing a different version for them, and then a different version for a wider audience.
Yeah.
Part of the reason being that they don't speak.
Spanish.
They don't speak Spanish. They only speak their language.
Yeah, some of them. Yeah,
and there was also I think something funny. We were thinking about how to start the movie, and we were in the studio, and so Will was looking up versions of the national anthem, and the national anthem was playing, and you and I was trying to show you like the Ken Burns effect of switching from, you know, photo to photo and kind of panning around. And as we were flipping through those pictures, it sort of synced up. And you were like, whoa, this, you know, what are, because in the lyrics of the national anthem, it's just something about the executioner.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the executioner came on, his face came up.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it seemed to make so much sense. That's how we could start the movie,
yeah.
is the national anthem flashing through these pictures of these, you know, villains.
Mm-hmm.
But then you said the people who this is about would not understand that sarcasm.
No.
Because they don't do sarcasm. And
yeah.
I could not believe that.
They have sarcasm in a different way, because the national anthem is very significant for, because we are Guatemalan.
Mm-hmm.
And the national anthem has important things and public activities and culture of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they have very respect for the national anthem. But the national anthem says that's one of those things the government introduced to respect the national anthem. And they don't know during the 80s what is the national anthem,
mm.
those years, because they live isolated,
mm-hmm.
they live lonely, a part of the nationality idea.
Mm-hmm.
So when the government came and introduced the national anthem, they have to sing every day, every morning,
mm-hmm.
a 5-minute song.
So they've been indoctrinated.
Yeah.
But they
yeah.
don't understand
yeah.
what they're singing.
No, because
so what are the lyrics that we're talking about? Because there were a few lines in there that stuck out.
Yeah, one of those is the executioner don't split your face.
Is it a threat within the national anthem? Like
yeah, the national anthem says que el verdugo no escupa tu faz, and faz is face,
mm-hmm.
because it's Latin,
mm-hmm.
but the face in Spanish is cara,
mm-hmm.
and in Chile is jolón.
Mm-hmm.
So the national anthem, they don't understand every word,
mm-hmm.
but the first part describe the somebody else don't invade
mm-hmm.
your land,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And that's
they're singing that as the land is being invaded.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's so
painful. During the yeah, yeah.
That's crazy, man. Well, I know. So you're very centered around the resistance. Do you intend on linking the story to any of the current events going on in Guatemala?
Yeah, yeah. I try to link it with the president.
Mm-hmm.
Who was the military in those years? It was the president in 2012. I tried to attach with the peace agreements, and yeah, that kind of things. I tried to connect.
And then the upcoming the rulings in February. Do you have any sense for how that's going to go?
Well, we hope it's a good decision for the communities. We hope, but it's more land, more cases. It's in the same situation. So they don't want to have a strong decision for one to affect the others.
Right. Yeah, you don't want it just to be...
Yeah, because it's like yeah. more than 15 cases in the same situation. Yeah, yeah. So... we hope it's a good decision. Yeah.
So let me just ask, like, what does the land mean to the people?
Well, the land, it's everything. They have a very connection with the mm-hmm. land, because they don't buy
mm-hmm.
the food.
Mm-hmm.
They grow food. So
and what does it mean that to the culture as well?
Well, they look a land like a person. They look the mountains person,
like a family member or something.
Like a father who protect, yeah. And they put a name to each mountain
mm-hmm.
around the area.
Mm-hmm.
They communicate with even a stone
mm-hmm.
have a part on the community.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't talk the stone. Mm-hmm. They talk about the stone like part of the community. Mm-hmm. So that's the connection, because even the wind have a role. Mm-hmm. When you grow food, mm-hmm. and you grow, you build a house, you ask for the wind, doesn't blow your plantations, doesn't blow your house, mm-hmm. because it's a strong wind. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you have a very connection with land and the environment. And that's the Mayan culture. Yeah, they have a very strong connection each other. Yeah.
So, do you have a timeline? Do you know where you're at in production? I know you have more information than you need right now.
Yeah,
so you're
I have 3 hours now,
yeah.
And I have to reduce 45 minutes. So,
oh boy.
I have many footage.
That's a lot.
To get rid of it.
And luckily, this is the kind of thing now that with laptops and technology and stuff like that, you could work on this on the plane, or you could work on it while you're traveling or something like that.
Yeah,
which is great.
Yeah.
Now, talk about the whole creative process, because did you go to film school or no?
No.
So you were just passionate about this and you wanted to tell the story.
Yeah, I work in that area, mm-hmm. like 5 years
okay
ago. And that particular case, it's strong. I have many footage and different cameras, mm-hmm. even the cellular. Mm-hmm. So I just film mm-hmm. and I don't have idea to what's the end, mm-hmm. what is the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You had a feeling that you should be shooting this, but you didn't know how.
Yeah, just shooting and yeah, they're images. It's not mine. I don't believe it's my images, like a documentary is their images. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask for permit, mm-hmm. to use it, mm-hmm. to editing, because mm-hmm. I respect that community, mm-hmm. and what they say, and those images, it's belong to the community. Mm-hmm. It's not belong to me. Mm-hmm. I just put it together. Yeah.
So I'm curious, like, do you feel like you were called to tell this story?
Yeah. It's difficult because it's the memory of the people. I born in 84, mm-hmm. when that land, it was stolen. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to me to decide what they want, mm-hmm. to put in the video. Yeah. It's hard, yeah. But it's necessary to think in how they want, what they want, mm-hmm. yeah.
So
because I editing this video, mm-hmm. for 14 communities. Mm-hmm. It's my goal, my public.
Wait a second. For how many?
14 communities. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
The video is going to be for 14 communities.
For 14 communities, okay. Yeah. And I have to reproduce like 5,000 copies.
Well, yeah, don't worry about that yet.
I think it's an amazing story.
Yeah. It's their story, yeah.
And I feel in some sense that you said you were born in 84.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps, you know, your ancestors called you to do this, tell this story.
Yeah. It's not casually, but it's intentional to mm-hmm. to create that story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we should wrap up. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for opening the space.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. We have a little music on the outro, I hope to get some more updates, and maybe we can do another conversation in a couple months and see where things are.
Okay. But I hope that finish.
Yeah.
I look forward to seeing it.
Just little by little. It'll be done, but you got to do it right.
Maybe we can show it at the library.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Thank you. Yeah.
And, you know, we will see you back at the Studio Lab again.
Yes.
You know, we still do our Studio Lab appointments on Mondays and Thursdays 1 to 5, so people can pop in and use the same stuff that you are. And yeah, we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For all the help.
Good luck.
This music is awesome.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts, covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.